Let's pick up where we left off in Genesis chapter 28. And just in way of review, when we went through chapter 27, we talked about how Isaac was deceived by Jacob and his mother Rebekah, and as a result, Esau became infuriated with Jacob, and then he threatened to kill his brother Jacob when his father was going to pass away. Keep a couple things in mind, too. It appeared from a human perspective that Isaac was on his last leg, so to speak. Isaac was about to die, but Isaac himself felt that. This is speculative on my part, but I'm assuming that Isaac was around 100 years old, but his health was probably failing pretty bad. So Rebecca and Isaac and Jacob and Esau, they all felt like his time was there. Isaac himself felt like, well, I'm going to die, my time is near. Apparently he was pretty sick at this particular time. So then he gave his son the blessing, but he was deceived and he ended up giving Jacob the blessing. But the irony is that Isaac almost outlived them all. Isaac didn't die till he was 185 years old. So God obviously had a different plan, a different method, a different way of doing things. But man, it gets impatient. He feels like he's got to help God out or push or force or manipulate things to have it his way, or the way that he thinks that God should work in his behalf. So instead, Jacob gets the blessing by deception, by deceiving his father, okay, with the help of his mother. And then his mother says, hey, okay, Jacob, you better get out of here because your brother's going to kill you. He says, hey, just go up to my brother's Laban's place, which is up in Haran, which was about a little over 400 miles from Beersheba, where he was at, in the southern portion of Israel. So he's going to make this trip up there. And his mother said, you'll be gone for a few days until your brother cools off and everything blows over, and then come back. Okay, well, little did she know that Jacob would be gone for 20 years, and in that time, she was going to end up herself dying before Isaac. Now, I only give you that as an overview because of the fact that they manipulated this situation, okay, so that Jacob could get the blessing. But they didn't have to do that because God has his own ways. Okay, and I want to emphasize this because, I'll be honest with you. I mean, just praying before Bible study, I mean, I have to just kind of think to myself, okay, where it says in the book of Isaiah, that God's thoughts aren't our thoughts. His ways aren't our ways. It just says the heavens are high, so are God's thoughts higher than our thoughts. I mean, if you look out into the heavens, I mean, there's no end to it. We have not found the end to the heavens. Okay? Well, in a sense, they're infinite. Okay? In that respect. In comparison to our own limited, finite reasoning and capacity to understand and comprehend. And sometimes, I was just telling the Lord this tonight before Bible study, sometimes that can be very, very frustrating. Because, you feel like you're almost like an amoeba underneath a microscope. And you feel like, hey, I don't comprehend. I don't understand what he's doing. But I just have to say, okay, the bottom line is, okay, I have to trust God. I have to wait on God. I have to exercise my faith. Even though it doesn't make any sense. He doesn't seem to be care. He doesn't seem to be doing anything. He doesn't seem to be opening any doors. Or, nothing seems to be moving. I still have to say, okay, his thoughts aren't my thoughts. So he's going to do things in a different way than I'm going to do it. So I have to wait, and I have to trust, and I have to believe, and just, wait on his timing. Well, that's the hardest thing in the world for any of us to do. I mentioned that last week, right? Well, here Jacob didn't wait. His mother didn't wait. They manipulated the situation. And now Jacob has got to run for his life from his brother, and unknown to Rebekah, she's never going to see him again because he's going to be gone for 20 years. But now he's on his way up to Haran, where Rebekah's brother is, Laban. And now Jacob's going to meet his match, because when he gets hooks up with Laban, Laban is going to be his father-in-law, but Laban is the master of deceit. Laban is the, he epitomizes one who lies and cheats and deceives and connives. And now Jacob is going to find himself in a situation where God is basically going to have to discipline him. And, I don't want to use the word punish, but he's going to have to chastise him. Okay, to break him of this self-will. It reminds me of a story I read at one time about a shepherd who was in the stable with a little ewe lamb whose leg was broken, and a woman had come in, and she thought, oh, gee, what happened to that poor little lamb? He says, well, it's got a broken leg. And obviously the lamb was in a lot of pain, and the woman felt so bad. She said, well, gee, how did that happen? He says, well, I broke it. He says, you broke it? He says, yeah, I broke it. He says, I'm going to tell you something about this little lamb here, this sheep. He says, every time I call the sheep, I got no problem. All the sheep follow me except this little lamb. This little lamb will always go and do his own thing. And I always got to, you know, go after him because he gets himself in very dangerous situations. He's walking along cliffs and very precarious situations and circumstances. And he says, not only that, he's beginning to get other sheep to follow him. But he says, I'll tell you right now, now that I've broken his leg, it'll heal in a relatively short period of time, but from now on, when this sheep hears my voice, he'll be the first one to pay attention to me. He will be more attentive to my voice than all the rest of the sheep. And as a matter of fact, he will be a leader of the sheep to get them to do what I want them to do. And sometimes that's the way God does in our life, right? He's got a discipline. Sometimes if we get out of God's will, you know, the Bible says in Proverbs, it says, he who hardens his neck after much reproof will suddenly be broken beyond repair. So it's almost as though God has to, you know, sometimes if he's going to chastise us, he's going to chastise us. And if we don't heed his dealing with us, there'll come a point where sooner or later he's going to just give us over to our own ways and we'll be broken beyond repair, and so to speak. So out of love for us, just like out of that shepherd's love for the sheep, he broke his leg, even though it seemed like a very cruel, inhumane, and hateful thing to do. He did it to save his life. And sometimes God will bring circumstances into our life to chastise us or to, you know, to actually prevent us from making bigger disasters in our life. And so this is what's going to happen to Jacob now. Now Jacob's going to be on the run. Okay, so it says here in that verse 1 in chapter 28, so Isaac and Jacob blessed him, and he charged him and said to him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Cana. Arise and go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take to yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May he also give you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your descendants with you, that you may possess the land for your sojournings which God gave to Abraham. Then Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Okay, if you remember from the latter portion of chapter 27, Rebekah, okay, goes into Esau, and she tells her husband, she says, look at the, you know, these wives of Esau have made me so miserable, I just want to die. He says, why don't you send Jacob up to my household up in Haran so he can get himself a wife? Well, she didn't tell him the whole truth. The whole truth was she was trying to save his sorry rear end from getting killed by his brother. Okay, that was the truth. She was kind of a conniver and a manipulator through this whole thing herself, right? All right? She didn't tell him the whole truth, but Isaac understood that as well. Because he said, don't let him take a wife from the Canaanites. Now, keep a couple of things in mind, okay? What we're dealing with here is we're dealing with the bloodline that goes all the way to Jesus Christ. And you almost have to go back to the first part of Genesis where we read about the Noahian flood. Because in that particular situation, if you recall, Noah, after the flood, it says that he got out of the ark and he planted himself a vineyard and then he, I guess, grew some grapes and then made some wine and he got drunk one night. And, you know, he got drunk and then he laid naked in his tent. And Ham, his son Ham, he had three sons. One was Shem, one was Jephthah, one was Ham. Ham goes into the tent, sees his father naked, laughs, and comes back out and tells his brothers and starts mocking his father. Okay, he starts mocking his father. Because he was in his drunken stupor naked. Well, his brother Jephthah and Shem, they took a cloak. They wouldn't even look at their father. They walked in backwards and covered him over. Well, when Noah got up out of his drunken stupor, he found out what had happened. He didn't say, cursed be Ham. What did he say?
Cursed be Cana.
He said, cursed be Cana. Now, Cana was the son of Ham. So, in other words, he said, cursed be Cana, you know, for what he has done. So, in other words, he cursed the descendants of Cana. So what we have here is the Canaanites here in the land, but God doesn't want them to be in this bloodline of Abraham through Jesus Christ. So in a way, God allows this to happen. So Jacob is now on his way up to Haran to find himself a wife. Okay, and as the story unfolds, it says here in that verse 6, it says, now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take himself a wife from there. And that when he blessed him, he charged him, saying, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. And Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. So Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan displeased his father Isaac, and Esau went to Ishmael and married, besides the wives that he had, Mahalath, the daughter of the Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nahelbeth. Now here's a situation. I know it gets a little bit confusing, but Esau now sees the situation where he says, well, my parents are really displeased, and they're displeased with me, and they're so frustrated with the wives that I've married, because apparently they were just making Rebecca miserable. So what he does, he goes to Ishmael. Anybody have any idea why he went to Ishmael?
Thinking that his parents will approve of marrying a relative.
Right, but keep something in mind. Ishmael was also a descendant of Abraham, okay, through his concubine Hagar. So I guess his reasoning was that, okay, if I go and get a wife who's basically a descendant from Abraham, then I'm going to get in good graces with my folks. And he may have even thought that he could somehow reverse the blessing that had been given to his brother. Okay, I don't want to read too much into this. I don't want to be too speculative. Okay, but I do see a slight application or parallel here. And that's that, you know, God has definitely laid out in very, very clear-cut terms, okay, what it is that we need to do to receive the blessing. And what I mean by the blessing, I mean the inheritance. None of us are going to inherit heaven. None of us are going to inherit eternal life unless we do what God has said. And God has basically said this: hey, this is my beloved son, hear him. We're talking about his son, Jesus Christ. Jesus himself said, I am the way, the truth, the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. Okay, now that's God's, they can't change that. The only way to heaven is through Jesus Christ. Now, the worldly mind, the worldly person is going to try to rationalize this out and say, well, there's got to be another way. Okay? And the worldly mind will always say something like this. Well, you know, God's a loving God, and everybody is eventually going to get to heaven. They reasoning like this, thinking, well, it's like being at the bottom of a huge mountain. It doesn't matter what side you climb the mountain from, you're all going to eventually get to the same place. Well, that's, you know, a humanistic, philosophy that has damned untold millions. The Bible says, and more than once, that there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. Okay, there's only one way to God, and that's through Jesus Christ. And I know that a lot of people have a problem with that. They say, well, what about the Aborigine in Africa or Australia? What about the pygmy in Africa? What about the Muslims who've never heard of Christ? Or what about these? And all I can say is this: hey, first of all, what about you? What about me? Okay? Right? Because Jesus said this. He says, whoever has been given much, much will be required of him. And look at what we've been given in this country. You know, you almost see a gas station on every corner. It's almost like you see a church on every corner. We have so much liberty and so much freedom in this country. You can go virtually any bookstore and buy a Bible. They don't have that kind of liberty. They don't have that kind of freedom in other parts of the world. We can hardly even imagine the type of persecution that goes on throughout the world, okay, against people who want to believe in Jesus Christ or commit their life to him. So the real question is, well, what are we doing with the light that's given us, rather than for us to worry about other people who have never been given the light? Because we are told in the book of Romans, God says this, that he has written his laws within our hearts. We don't really need a Bible to give us the Ten Commandments, so that we can know right from wrong. Okay, it certainly helps, but in our hearts, instinctively, God's put it there. We know it's wrong to steal. We know it's wrong to lie. We know it's wrong to cheat. We know it's wrong to murder. We know it's wrong to commit adultery. We know all of these things are wrong. Okay, why? Nobody had to tell us. It's instinctive within us because God has written his laws within our heart. And God says in Romans that he's going to judge people on that basis who have never heard of Jesus Christ. All right? So we don't have to worry about, well, what's God going to do to those people? What we have to worry about, man, we've been given so much light. What am I going to do with the light that I've been given? Because, let's face it, we are going to have a much stricter judgment. All right? But here's Esau thinking to himself, well, maybe I can get this blessing back by, you know, getting in good graces with my parents by getting another wife. You know, like that's going to help. Okay, well, people do this. They reason in all kinds of different ways. Well, I'm going to get in good graces with God if I give to the Cub Scouts, the Boy Scouts, or I do some crazy thing that they think is going to get them over. But the only thing that's going to get us over is to come to God on His terms. And that come to God on His terms means, hey, we got to take a good, hard, cold look at ourselves and say, hey, in me there's no good thing. Okay, I'm a sinner from the word go. And if you know yourself, you know it's true. If you look deep within your heart, you're going to say, hey, what's wrong with me? You know? You got to clear away all the claptrap and look deep within your heart and say, hey, by nature I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm egotistical, I'm proud, I'm lustful, I'm arrogant. This is the way I am. I would say to you this, okay, because I know it's true of me. I don't know if any of you have stopped to reflect upon it and think about it. Imagine you have your life where everything kind of goes your way, okay? In other words, you enjoy your job, you get a lot of satisfaction out of it. Everybody you meet, you know, you get along with really good. Nobody rubs you the wrong way. You're in a blissful marriage where everything is just hunky-dory. You've got money coming out your ears. Everything is going fine. I mean, you'd be an easygoing person to be around, wouldn't you?
All the circumstances going
right, because all the circumstances are going your way, right? You know, but now reverse all those circumstances, and then we'll see the real person come out. You can almost guarantee it, all right? But that's where God, a lot of times, you know, will use the hammer and the chisel and the saw and the grinder and the sandpaper and the polisher to do what? To fashion and shape and mold us into images of His Son. And you know, for Christ to shine through us, like you said, a lot of times it's going to take circumstances that, you know, are going to require us to really die to our true self. When I say our true self, I mean the nature within us that is selfish and self-centered and egotistical and proud, the thing that's got to die within us. You're looking at Esau. Esau's trying to get into good graces with his folks by doing what? By doing something that's not going to improve the situation one bit. But he's attempting to do that. And a lot of times people think they can improve their situation with their Heavenly Father. How? By doing things that have nothing to do with what is really required of them. Esau made a big mistake, you know, by marrying the wrong women. I'm sure he regretted that. But then he goes out and tries to, again, get into good graces with his parents by marrying somebody who Abraham stalked. But again, he missed the boat. All right? I didn't want to get up on a tangent there, but I think sometimes we have to really take a look at things from God's perspective rather than our own. So what happens to Jacob? At the beginning of verse 10, it says, "Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went towards Haran. And he came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and laid down in that place. And he had a dream. And behold, a ladder was on the earth, and its top was reaching into heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, 'I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and Isaac, the land of which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like that dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you.' Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, 'Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it.' And he was afraid and said, 'How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven.' So Jacob arose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on his top, and he called the name of the place Bethel. However, previously, the name of the city had been Luz." Now, before we go any further, let's back up here a little bit. And it says that Jacob was on his way up to Haran, and he comes to this place called Bethel, which is about 45 miles from Beersheba. So it may have taken him, you know, probably a minimum of 2 days' journey at this particular time. Maybe it even took him longer. But he's been on his road for at least a couple of days. He gets to this place called Luz, okay? And like I said, it's 45 miles due north of Beersheba, okay? So he's been traveling almost 50 miles. And he gets there. He's exhausted. He's tired. And he's probably wondering, he's probably looking over his shoulder and wondering if Esau has happened to follow him, okay? That's speculative on my part. But let's face it, he's alone, and he's somewhat destitute, and he's in a desperate situation. And it says that he lies down and he uses a rock for a pillow. And I think that's kind of significant. I don't worry too much of that either, but it does say in the Bible, and I think it's in Proverbs, is that the way of a transgressor is hard. Okay, well, he's made his bed, now he's got to lay in it, you know, this type of thing. Well, this course that he set on in his life is going to be a difficult course. But he's laying down, and he falls dead asleep, and he has this vision, he has this dream. And in this dream, he says he sees his angels ascending and descending this ladder. And at the top of the ladder is God Almighty. And they're ascending and descending on this ladder. And then God speaks to him, all right, from this. And he says that I am the God of your father Abraham and Isaac. He reiterates the promises that he made to Abraham and Isaac, saying that he was going to bless Jacob. And his descendants would be as the dust of the ground. In other words, they would be innumerable. Okay? And that he would give them this land, and his descendants would spread out from the north, from the south, and from the east and to the west. All right? So he gives them all of these promises. And then Jacob, he wakes up out of this dream and he says, surely the Lord was in this place. And I didn't know it. And then he builds a little altar there. But I think what's kind of significant to me is how often God will be in a certain place and we won't know it. We won't know it. In a way, we should know it, but we don't know it. In other words, to give you an example, Jesus said this, where two or more gather in my name, there I am in the midst of you. Okay, we take that promise to heart, and I believe, in my mind's eye, I can see that Jesus is in our midst. Not because of me, not because of you, but because he promised that where two or more gather in name, he is in our midst. So, by the eye of faith, I believe, without a shadow of doubt, that he is in this room right now. All right? But let me say something, okay? I think it's kind of interesting. The Rolling Stones were in town and last night, and a girl that I worked with, she paid $250 for a ticket to see the Rolling Stones. I mean, you couldn't give me $250 to go see them, but she paid $250 for the seat. And I'm thinking, holy smoke. You know, what amazes me is that the Lord is in this place, and it's free. Nobody going to charge you tickets. The Lord is in this place. But how many people know it? How many people, you know, like, for example, a church on Sunday. The Lord is there. But how many people really know it? Okay? What comes before the Lord? Well, you know, the football game, the Super Bowl, my golf game. You name it. The list goes on and on and on. I mean, it amazes me the number of excuses that people will come up with why they can't go to church on Sunday. All right? They say, well, you know, it's drizzling out. But if it was a blizzard out, they would find, you know, the time, the money, the effort, the energy to get up to Tahoe if they wanted to, right? A wreck fall, right? Right? I mean, we can always do what we want to do. We will always find the time, the money, the energy, the effort to do what we really want to do. Okay? I mean, I've mentioned this before. What really determines the value of something? Right. How much you're willing to pay for it. Well, this girl paid $250 for a Stones ticket. That's, you know, there's a big value put on that, right? Well, how many people, they don't go to church, you know, because they come up with one flippant excuse after the other. But what it really boils down to, if you clear through all the smoke and the smoke screen and the claptrap and everything else, get down to the body and the nitty-gritty is, hey, I don't put much value on it. God, to me, doesn't have a whole lot of value. Oh, we give him the mental assent. He's just kind of a cuddly mascot when he's there when we need him, but what kind of value do we put on it? And also, you know, God is also in, you know, here's Jacob in a very difficult situation in his life. But God is in the situation. He created this mess, but God is in it. How many times we might be in a situation in our life where, you know, we feel like, well, I've really made a mess of things. Or you may be in a situation where you didn't really have anything to do with it, but you're in the middle of it. I don't care whether you've been wiped out and devastated by a flood, a hurricane, a forest fire, or, you know, or whatever. Look at all these people down at in Columbia, where there's thousands of people dead there and thousands homeless, and everything is such ruin and destruction. But yet I can guarantee you, God is in that. Okay? He's in that. Look at the book of Revelation, for example, okay? In the book of Revelation, you will not read of more destruction and more calamity and more death and dying and sickness and disease and no. I mean, this is God's punishment, and it seems like God has just gone berserk as far as his anger is concerned. But to the discerning mind, what they really see in that is they see God's mercy. Because what we're told in the book of Revelation, John, when he has this vision in heaven, he sees a multitude of people, so many that no man can number them. And he says they come from every tribe and every tongue and every nation, every language. They're in heaven, and they've been given white robes, and they have palm branches. And then John asks the angel, he says, who are these? And the angel says, these are the ones who have washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb, and they've come through the great tribulation. And there's a multitude of them, so many that no man can number them, and they're from every nation on earth. And they come through this tribulation, and the reason that they are in heaven is because God sent them such tribulation that they finally got their head out of the sand. They got down on their knees and cried out to God for mercy. And if their lives remain satisfactory, or everything just went on an even keel, with hardly any bumps or bruises along the way, they'd end up in hell. Now, this is a sad thing, right? And it's very true. But as long as a person's life is halfway satisfactory to themselves, in other words, if everything's okay, the chances are, slim to none, that they will have anything to do with God on a serious level. But, you know, God's not proud. You know, he'll stoop to conquer. He'll have us, even though we've shown him that, hey, listen, you're the last thing in the world I want. But since I'm so desperate, okay, I'll take you. He says, I'll take you. I says, well, he'll have us. Okay, well, that's what he has to do sometimes, is get us in that position where, you know, we're, we got nowhere else to go but down on our knees, nowhere else to look but up, right? Before we get so desperate, we say, okay, I don't want you, but, you know, you're all I've got left, so I'll take you. He says, well, good, I'll have you. And that's a shame. I mean, you know, it's almost insulting to God, but, you know, I think that we've all, most of us, including myself, you know, have to admit to my shame and to our shame that, hey, you know, it's true. But then God, in his mercy, you know, will bring us through these hard-pressed places to bring us to himself, and then as a result of that, will end up, you know, giving us a new life, a new meaning, a new purpose, a new direction, and blessings on top of that, and, you know, where we would never have received if we just... if our lives just continue to go on in that, well, I'm satisfied kind of mode, that cruise control that we've been on, or whatever you want to call it. But anyway, a couple other things to keep in mind here is that he said he had this dream of this ladder that was reaching into heaven. Does anybody remember in the New Testament where Jesus referred to this? In a time of Jesus' life, okay, when he was getting together his disciples, he calls Nathanael. Let me just read you the situation. It says that, now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said to him, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Philip said to him, come and see. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said to him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile. Nathanael said to him, how do you know me? And Jesus answered and said to him, before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Nathanael answered him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And Jesus answered and said to him, because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You shall see greater things than these. Now listen. And he said to him, truly, truly, I say to you, you shall see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Now Jacob has this vision, okay? 2,000 years before Jesus spoke this, Jacob has this dream that he sees this ladder reaching into heaven, and the angels are ascending and descending, okay? And God the Father is on the top of this ladder. But here, Jesus said that you will see, there's coming a day when you will see the angels of heaven ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. He was referring to a time when Jesus is going to be ruling on the earth during his millennial kingdom. What did this ladder represent? It represents Jesus Christ, because again, he is, I am the way, the truth, life. No man comes to the Father except through me. He is our only way to heaven, our only way to God. Okay, and our, you know, it's our communion with God, you know, in a sense, in a symbolic sense, through this ladder. That's that connection between God and heaven, or heaven and earth, and God and man. All right, through Jacob's ladder, so to speak. All right, Well, Jesus made reference to that. As a matter of fact, I think it was kind of interesting. I think Nathaniel was kind of a wiseacre because, you know, when Philip said, "Hey, come, hey, we found the Messiah. We found the one that Moses talked about and the prophets talked. We found him." He says, "He's from Nazareth," and he said, and Nathaniel said, "Hey, can anything good come out of Nazareth?" It's like, you know what I mean? It's like, "Hey, can anything good come out of San Francisco?" So when Jesus sees him coming, he says, "Here comes a true Israelite in whom there is no guile." Meaning what? What's guile? Yeah, deceit. I mean, you know, I don't want to get off on tangent again, but man, it's so important that we recognize that God really looks for people who have integrity, people who are honest, okay? All right? And none of us are perfect, okay? But there's a lot to be said about a person who is honest, who is trustworthy, who is a person of their word, okay? I mean, I've dealt with pathological liars. You know, it's like you can't believe anything the person says, because they have such a reputation for being so untruthful. Well, we know from a human perspective how loathsome that can be, right? All right, and we don't really have anything to do with people like that on any kind of deep level, right? You certainly wouldn't want to trust this person with anything, right? Well, how much more if we feel this way towards a person who's a pathological liar or somebody who's deceit, you know, does God have this kind of aversion to? Well, here he sees a man who says, "Well, here's an honest man." And it's refreshing to see an honest man. It is refreshing to deal with honest people, isn't it? Well, that's what God said of Nathanael. I think his name is also Bartholomew. Okay. But I kind of got off on a tangent here. But, you know, again, we're looking at the situation where you see Jacob's ladder and you see what it represents. And I really think that Jesus himself, when he revealed this to Nathanael, about the latter, that what's coming in the future. I think in a sense, it was a privilege or a grace that God gave to Nathanael, and I think that God he got it, that kind of grace, because of he was that kind of a person. He was just that honest of a person. It didn't take a whole lot to convince Nathanael, did it? Jesus said, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." He said, "Whoa, wow, man, you must really be the Son of God." You know, didn't take hardly anything to convince him. Look what Jesus did, for example, in comparison. Look when he raised Lazarus from the dead. Lazarus is in the grave for 4 days. And they said, "Man, don't even open the grave up, man. It stinks in there." And then Jesus said, "Roll back the stone." And then Jesus says, "Lazarus, come forth." And then Lazarus comes forth after being dead for 4 days. And he's all bound up like a mummy. And he says, "Unbound him." Well, it says that a lot of people believe when they see this incredible miracle. But then it also said the scribes and the Sadducees and religious leaders hardened their hearts so bad when they seen this that they determined that they were going to kill Jesus from that day on. And not only that, they determined that they were going to kill Lazarus. He was going to die all over again because they're, "Hey, this guy's too hot to handle." What I'm pointing out is here Nathanael believes because Jesus told him, "Well, I saw you under the fig tree." Didn't take much for him to believe, did it? And here he shows a tremendous miracle to some people who have such hardened hearts, they're not going to believe anything. Yeah, Kevin.
I've just thought that, it doesn't say what Nathanael was thinking under that tree, but, you know, what if he was thinking something like, you know, feeling down, questioning his faith or whatever, and just asking God, "Do you even know I'm here? Can you see me?"
Yeah.
And then Jesus, before Philip,
right.
"I saw you."
Right.
Bingo.
Right.
You know, that reminds me of Pat's testimony when he got shot with that AK-47. Because he was, you know, had been a Christian for a while, walking with the Lord, and he said he just had those doubts that, you know, how can God know what I'm thinking? You know, I'm one of so many people. Does he really care about me? And then God just gave him that miracle where that guy shot at him from 10 feet away with that rifle and
missed him every time.
Missed him, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, he cared. He had his hand over him, covered him and protected him.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like God is so far away so often, you know. I mean, it does. I mean, you know, everyday life, he's going through this dry, arid, you know, routine that God just seems so distant. I mean, before Bible study tonight, I was just down praying, and it just seemed so distant from me. You just wish that you could feel him or sense him or that he was close by. But it's amazing that the Bible says he's closer to us than our next breath. I remember one time, this was many, many years ago when I was writing my books, And one of the books, I was in the process of writing, I think, my third book, and I was in a restaurant, and I was just writing it, and I was going over what I had written. It seemed so terrible to me. I mean, I just kept crumpling up one sheet of paper after another, and I was just saying, this is terrible. And I just, you know, just got so depressed, and I thought, man, you know, this is so bad, you know. Man, I bet you God's even ashamed of me. And I said that to myself, and immediately this voice within me said, John, if you had a four-year-old son, and he came home from school, and he worked so hard on his finger painting, and he showed it to you, he gave it to you, he did it for you, would you be ashamed of that? I mean, that thought just came out of nowhere. It just hit me like wham. I had, you know, it was like it was such a conviction, like God just spoke to me in my heart. Now, I didn't hear an audible voice, okay? Nothing, the heavens didn't open up, I didn't hear this voice come down. It was like, you know, I'm just thinking, oh, even God is ashamed of me. And I just felt like so low. And it was like he just said, John, wake up. You know, would you feel this way if your son did this for you? I mean, it was like it was just wham. It was like that the realization, well, God knew what I was thinking. And we're told in the Psalms that God knows our thoughts from afar. You know, even before we say anything, he knows. And he knows what he's going to say. You know, even though we can feel so distant from him so often, and so, you know, so far removed from him, he's right there. He's closer to us than our next breath. You know, and that is encouraging or comforting. But like I said, it didn't take much for Nathaniel, right? But, you know, how many people are unlike Nathaniel, but they're like these, you know, scribes and Pharisees who, regardless of what God does, they're not going to believe. They're just not, because they're hell-bent to have their own way. They don't want God in their life. Why? Because as soon as they accept God in their life, they recognize that they can't be their own God. They have to submit to him. They're going to be accountable to him. You know, so they don't want anything to do with him. So they kind of rationalize him away. Anyway, okay. Verse 15, and behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and did not know it, and he was afraid, and he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. So Jacob arose in the morning and took the stone he had put under his head and set it on as a pillar and poured oil on the top of it, and he called the name of the place Bethel. However, previously, the name of had been Luz. Now Bethel means house of God, and he says, now then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and I will give me food to eat and garments to wear, I will return to my father's and I return to my father's house in safety. Then the Lord will be my God, and this stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and of all that thou dost give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee. Okay, now God has basically made Jacob a promise. Now Jacob basically just says, okay, now if God is going to watch over and protect me and provide for me, you know, and if he's going to give me a safe journey up to my uncle's or Laban's and then bring me back to this place, you know, then I'm definitely going to make God my God, okay? And he's basically basing that on God's promises. Okay, well, God is going to do this to me, for me, then I'm certainly going to make him my God. And as a result, he said, I'm also going to give him a tenth of all my possessions. This is the second mention, actually, of tithing in the Bible. Remember, I think it was chapter 14, we read about Abraham, how he gave a tenth of his spoils to Melchizedek, the high priest Melchizedek. Well, here Jacob mentions that he's going to give a tenth of what he possesses back to God. And I don't want to get up on tangent on this either, but I kind of a closing note. It says a lot in regards to what we do with our possessions. There's kind of a rule of thumb that, we really should strive to give God 10% of our income. Granted, you know, I don't want to put anything in stone in terms of, well, you have to do that. I know some churches do that, you know. But all I'm saying is this. You know, how we treat our possessions or money, to be more specific, okay, says an awful lot about us. See, especially in this country, there's this kind of, well, I don't even want to call it work ethic. It's basically, hey, make money and then make more money and then make more money with more money and more money with more money. But I think that if we have an attitude where we hold things in this life loosely. I mean, I really try to pray for that every day, that God will help me to hold everything in this life loosely. In other words, you're not going to cling to anything tenaciously to where, you know, if God says, hey, I want that, and you say, oh, over my dead body, you know. Well, we have to realize that everything I own belongs to God. Everything. You know, there was a story, I forget that, this is from an evangelist down in Argentina. He wrote a book, and it's called, in the book he talks about this, the pearl of great price. And in this particular book, he says that this is a fable. You know, this guy's walking along this street corner, and he's just window shopping, looking in different various stores and shops. And he looks through this one shop, and he sees this massive pearl, this huge, gigantic pearl, and it is just gleaming and glistening. And he's just taken back by the size of this humongous pearl, and he just can't believe it. He goes in that shop out of curiosity, and he goes up to the proprietor and says, man, how much is that pearl? I can't believe it. He says, well, it costs an awful lot. I said, well, I can sure imagine it must cost an awful lot. He says, man, who in the world could buy such a thing? He says, well, anybody. I said, well, what do you mean, anybody? He says, hey, you know, you just said it costs an awful lot. I says, yeah, but anybody can buy it. He says, well, what do you mean anybody can buy it? He says, yeah, anybody can buy it. He says, well, what does it cost? He says, cost everything you got. The guy thought for a second. He says, well, listen, I'll buy that. He says, okay, fine. So the proprietor gets out a piece of paper and a pencil, and he says, okay, now, what do you have? He says, well, I got $10,000. And he writes down $10,000. I said, oh, great. You know, I'll go down to the bank. I'll withdraw all my money, and I'll come right back and give you a cashier's check for $10,000. He says, well, fine. He says, well, what else you got? He says, well, that's it. That's all my life savings, the $10,000. He says, well, do you have a car? He says, yeah, I have two cars. He says, oh, write it down, two cars. He says, oh, you're going to take my cars? He says, yeah. And he says, what else you have? Well, he says, I have a camper. He says, well, write down one camper. Wow, you're going to take my camper? He says, well, what else do you have? He says, well, I have a job. He says, okay, well, I'll write that down. One job. He says, well, what else do you have? He says, well, I got a wife and two kids. He says, well, write that down. Wife and two kids. The guy, holy smoke, you know, you mean it when he says everything. He says, well, what else do you have? He says, well, just a shirt on my back and the 37 cents in my pocket. He writes that down. Shirt on your back, 37 cents in your pocket. You know? And he says, you know, well, what else do you have? He says, nothing. You've got everything. He says, okay, well, this is what it's going to cost you to buy that pearl. And now the guy's really, oh, man, I don't know if I want this or not, but he kept looking at that pearl, and he wants that pearl, and wants that so bad. He says, fine. He says, okay, I'll do it. You can have, you know, my wife, my kids, my camper, my house, my, you know, you can have it all. And the guy says, okay, fine. He says, here's your pearl. He says, I'll tell you what. He says, I will allow you to use your house, your cars, your camper, your clothes, okay, and I will allow you to live with your wife and your kids, but you understand now, they belong to me. And any time that I request any or all those things, recognize that they belong to me, and you need to give them to me immediately. So the guy walks out with this massive pearl with everything that he went in with. He still has. But now the ownership, he recognizes, has been transferred. And that everything that he once owned now belongs to this proprietor. Same thing with us and God, right? Everything in this life, we got to recognize we don't own. It belongs to God. If we give our life to God, then he owns. He owns our house, you know? And if he sees fit to, you know, to let it go up in smoke, hey, it's going to be a hard thing to deal with, but we have to do what Job did and just say, you know, say, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I leave this world. So it's like, hey, you know, it belongs to God. Now, that's a tough thing to deal with, right? But everything in this life is just temporary, right?
God knows best.
Right. And so if we turn it over to God, then, in a sense, they don't possess us. We possess them. Does anybody have anyone to add or share what we read?